and welcome to another episode of Radio War Nerd. The day today is May 2nd, 2022, and this is episode 328. This is Radio War Nerd. You're listening to it, patreon.com/Radio War Nerd. I'm the host, Mark Ames, here in Rochester. You know the Great Lake. John, you're on the other side of the Great Lake. They know the Great Lake. Let's get straight to our interview, right, John?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so let's get straight to our guest. He's online with us right now. Journalist Seth Harp. He's an investigative reporter, contributing editor at Rolling Stone, and we'll definitely want to talk with him about one of his really great pieces from Rolling Stone about the Fort Bragg murders and suicides. And he has spent the last month in Ukraine for Harper's Magazine for a big article that's going to be coming out in about a month, month and a half from now in Harper's. And so first of all, I just want to welcome Seth and thank him for coming on to talk to us about Ukraine and his reporting as well. So first of all, welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on, Seth.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me. Hey, John. Good to be talking to you guys.
We're looking forward to this one.
Yes, very much, because I've been whining and whinging and complaining nonstop, well, you know, more than probably most people want to hear, about the fact that in all of the deluge of information and data and reporting and OSINT and SITREP and everything that we're getting out of Ukraine, we literally get nothing concrete about the state and the condition of the Ukrainian forces that the U.S. and the West are fully in with right now. I mean, we get a general abstraction that they have high morale, that they're fighting a righteous war. We know about how brilliantly they're commanding the information war. We know, apparently, you know, that they have performed well against at least the initial debacle phase of the of Russia's invasion, but we don't know how many casualties they've. All we hear about are the casualties, you know, that the Russian side has taken. And Seth reached out to me on Twitter, which I really appreciate. And I didn't know you were out there. Actually, I knew you from your interview with Truanon to say how basically impossible it was for a Western reporter to find out anything about what's going on there beyond what is controlled by the Ukrainian side. And that's really interesting and really important to know. So first of all, Seth, I don't know where we start here, but you know, I appreciate you like reaching out to me and letting me know that. When did you first go to Ukraine and how long were you there and where did you stay and stuff?
I was there from about March 20th or so till about April 26th, starting in Lviv and then ending in Kyiv. And, you know, it's very true what you say about the control over information. And I think that a lot of reporters may be reluctant to talk about it or admit it because when you're there, you're afraid that you're just failing at your job and you're just not getting the access that other people are getting. But over time, it, you know, at least for me, it just sort of dawned on me that, hey, no one else is able to visit the front lines either. Like no one else is doing interviews with commanders. No one else is going to field hospitals. You know, there aren't good casualty numbers. And it slowly, you know, dawned on me that it's just a result of the extraordinarily restrictive media environment that's over there. It's much more restrictive than in other war zones that I've worked in. And we can talk about, you know, how exactly the Ukrainians are accomplishing that. But, you know, suffice it to say, they have a very streamlined media operation.
Right.
Well, so it doesn't hit in terms of getting to Ukraine, right? You're welcome to come to Kyiv, I would think. So that part is easy. When does it get difficult?
Or is it easy? Or how hard
or,
is
yeah,
it?
Is it yeah. easy?
It is easy to get across the border. I mean, you can, with an American passport, at least, you can just go right in. And partly that's to facilitate all of the, you know, volunteers that are coming across, all of the flows of supplies, equipment, weapons, and so forth. The border with Poland is wide open in both directions. Where it gets difficult is if you try to go anywhere near the zones of active fighting. And the entire time I was in Ukraine, it was very unclear where Ukrainian units were positioned, you know, where they were positioned relative to Russian units. There's just, you know, the UA map or UA live map that has these red zones on it, but those are very approximate and don't really tell you like where are the checkpoints, and what are the formations that control those, and how are they changing over time? That remained entirely unclear the whole time I was in Ukraine.
Right.
Were you given a minder, or were you allowed to drive as far as you could?
I wasn't given a minder. I don't think I went anywhere. Like, I didn't drive my own car. The trains, amazingly, are still running all over Ukraine.
Oh.
And, you know, there was actually, just a side note, there was a great article in The Guardian about the train workers union and the extraordinary solidarity that they've shown during the war in terms of evacuating people and keeping the trains running, which is just critical for people getting around the country. But no, I didn't have a minder, but you can't approach the front lines because, you know, there's checkpoints everywhere. There's document checks almost at every intersection. When I first got to Kyiv, while the battle there was still going on. So, I mean, if you were to try it, you would just be turned back.
Those checkpoints, if I'm not mistaken, are manned by the territorials, who can be anybody, including some very unsavory people, right?
Well, the territorial defense is a very loosely organized reserve militia. It's very unclear what, you know, or how many people are in it, but, you know, anywhere, the estimates are anywhere from 200,000 to 900,000.
Wow.
There's tons of people that are in the territorial defense that pretty much anybody can join, or like most Ukrainian men of military age have tried joined, but few of them actually have the new enlistees have weapons. You know, they just, or uniforms are just identified by like a blue armband, like a blue piece of tape around. So there are like the first checkpoints that you'll come to are very informal with, you know, guys who are in civilian clothes carrying shotguns or whatever. As you get farther towards the front, because I did approach as far as I could on a number of occasions, then you'll start seeing the really, you know, hardcore, you know, regular Ukrainian army guys. And they're very serious about, you know, the checkpoints. When they look at your passport, they'll go through every single page of it, you know, looking for Russian stamps, presumably.
Right.
You know, there are a lot of Russian spies in Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
So their security concerns are very understandable, but for a reporter, you know, my experience was just made it impossible to understand what was going on during the defense of Kyiv.
Right. Did you have a translator?
Yeah. From time to time, I had various translators I work with. Different ones.
Yeah. Right. And where did you stay? I mean, like, did you stay in a hotel in Kyiv, or did you stay in like somebody's apartment, or how'd you work that?
In Kyiv, I stayed at a hotel. I'll tell a little anecdote about the Premier Palace Hotel, where a lot of journalists were staying at.
Mm-hmm.
I came down one morning from my room, and there was like 100+ soldiers and police just like camped out on the ground floor of the hotel. And they were everywhere throughout the hotel. And it's a kind of a fancy hotel. Mm-hmm. And they were like hanging out, you know, sitting on the grand piano, sitting, smoking cigars in like the smoking room. It was like an occupation. I had no idea what was going on. I asked the reception, and because, you know, these guys had just come off the front lines. I mean, you could smell it on. They smelled like dirty laundry, stale cigarette smoke, you know.
Yep.
And I asked the receptionist what's going on. And he's like, oh, it's no problem. You know, they just want to talk to somebody who's here. And the Ukrainian forces had put up like these banners, in the hotel, like showing what I gather was like the ownership structure of the hotel. And basically they had come to seize this property, in a very dramatic way with a large force. And I could not figure out at all what was going on. Like I asked, you know, Ukrainian people that I knew, like, what's going on here? And, you know, one woman told me that, hey, this is typical for Ukraine. Like sometimes properties change hands without any, you know, paperwork being signed or without any deals.
Raids is what I mean. Yeah. And you use muscle. That's where like a lot of these Azov and Right Sector guys, you know, that was their job before the war in Donbas started, was working with oligarchs to physically seize other oligarchs' properties.
interesting that that goes on during the war.
I know. That's really wild. I wonder whose property it was.
Well, I tried to look into it afterwards, you know, try to find some kind of news article, talk to Ukrainian journalists, and there was nothing. It wasn't there. Nothing was written about it. No one could tell me what had happened. And that incident, although relatively minor, kind of impressed on me that, like, I had no fucking clue what's going on in this country. And,
well,
like, who the
what's interesting is I gather there were a lot of other Western journalists in this hotel. I mean, none of them pursued that story.
There were a lot of Western journalists there from major, you know, publications. And yeah, like I said, I couldn't find anything about it afterwards.
No, but as John said, you know, you're doing a one single deep dive story, so that wouldn't really be your thing. But there are a lot of journalists who need to file some, at least one thing a day, if not several. And it's just kind of interesting that nobody, maybe they tried pushing and their editors were like, well, that's not relevant. They didn't want to hear it. A lot of times editors kind of drive these things, I guess. But it's just interesting that that story, which is really interesting, and had that happened in Russia, where journalists were staying, you know, reporting on the war, and then there was a raid like that, as they call, like, that would have been a pretty big, interesting story. Or if it was before this war, it would have been an interesting story. So
definitely. And you know, I really don't have the budget to be staying at places like Premier Palace, but because I had just gotten done with some rough work for a week or so and was really tired, I just kind of splurged on it because they have like a spa and a swimming pool. But it's one of the nicest hotels in Kyiv, if not the nicest, and certainly someone would very much like to own that property. Like, this is a place that's worth a ton of money. So I certainly was made curious by that incident, and all I could learn was that the owners were apparently linked to Yanukovych. That was the most specific that anyone could be when I try to.
I mean, I wonder if it has something to do with some kind of relationship to the opposition bloc party and Medvedchuk's party. You know, Medvedchuk, the leader of the opposition party, who's jailed and then kind of held as hostage now, I guess. He escaped and he's accused of treason, and then they captured him apparently, and the Ukrainians want to exchange him for somebody in Russia. Mm-hmm. This is the guy who's presumably the godfather to Putin's daughter, apparently. So maybe it's something connected to that. I'm trying to think, or an oligarch who backs that party aside from Medvedchuk. But who knows? I mean, Ukraine is one of the most corrupt countries on the planet by even very friendly, you know, ratings agencies. So, and this is not uncommon before the war. So that's interesting. Yeah, really interesting.
And Ukrainians are very reluctant to talk. Politics and like power in the country. It seems like there seems to be a sort of cultural aversion to at least speaking to outsiders about that. And I pretty quickly came to the conclusion that I didn't understand who was really in charge in Ukraine, like who exactly, like what is the Zelensky government exactly? I mean, we know, of course, that there's Zelensky, but I think everyone kind of agrees that he's more or less a spokesman, a very good spokesman, incidentally. He's a talented media guy, but who is behind him? You know, who are the particular oligarchs that back him, or what are the industrial interests that are behind him? Like, what political factions are opposed to him? Those kind of questions I made very little headway in getting to the bottom of. And it made me feel a bit skeptical about the almost like euphoric Western support for Ukraine, although it's certainly understandable response to the, you know, completely illegal invasion by Russia. But I think that there is room for folks to be a little bit more reserved or reserving judgment, since it's very unclear who exactly is in charge in Ukraine.
Well, if I can follow up on the question about your colleagues, the Western reporters who were staying there, I have this idea that reporters talk to each other. Maybe that's not true anymore. I don't know, but I thought they would have. Where did they get their information, and what were they talking about when they talked with each other?
So a minute ago, I mentioned the Ukrainians, media savvy. And in addition to the sort of restrictions that they place on where you can go, I think even more effective is their creation of media centers. There's one in Lviv that's in like this amazing three-story brewery that looks like a place you might see in Brooklyn or Austin. It's a very comfortable place to hang out if you're, you know, a reporter who's traveling. Free coffee, you know, there's people there that can assist you, that can like print stuff. There's great Wi-Fi. There are like daily briefings that are held there. You sign up on their list and you get a daily brief from the press officers. But beyond that, it's almost impossible to get information that doesn't come through that centralized channel. So there's a great deal of homogeneity in the reports that are coming out of Ukraine, I think largely because reporters are just going and hanging out at these centers and they're all getting exactly the same material.
Yeah, I don't think most people know that. That's remarkable.
Which would explain why so many of the reports kind of look similar, you know, and yeah. None of them are from the front lines or from hospitals showing bodies and stuff. It's,
right.
It's all, yeah.
Right.
What about hospital access? You can't get access to hospitals with the wounded from combat?
I was unable to get any access. Yeah. I was able to go to a hospital. They let me talk to some volunteers that were there in a kind of little outbuilding. But as far as entering the hospital itself, there was no way. Mm-hmm. And that was the main military hospital in Kyiv. You know, I would have understood if they wanted to restrict, you know, field hospitals. But
who runs these media centers? I bet they have some nice media savvy people doing that.
With Western consultants, I'll bet.
Yeah. Very much so. I'm certain that there are Western consultants behind it, although I actually don't know that for a fact. But the aesthetics of these places are so slick that it seems clear. Like you walk in there and they issue you a badge and you get to walk around with a lanyard and you know, and feel like important and stuff. Mm-hmm. But to answer your question, John, it's the military, the Ministry of Defense runs these media centers.
So getting back to the point you made about Zelensky and not knowing, you know, where power is and Ukrainians reluctant to talk. I mean, I think that's something that, like, Ukraine is at a very lively, wild, investigative journalism, tabloid journalism scene before the Maidan Revolution, after the Maidan Revolution. After the Maidan Revolution, frankly, it got a lot harder. Violence against investigative journalists got a lot worse in some ways. Very famously, Pavel Sheremet was blown up from Ukrainian Pravda, a great investigative media outlet. He was blown up. And the people that they've traced it back to, they always have ties either to the Interior Ministry, although that guy's finally now gone, or the SBU, which of course is the former KGB. And these guys, I mean, the violence against journalists is a really big deal, and they've been shutting down journalists and driving them out of the country. Last year, Zelensky was sort of, initially he was kind of a thaw and all that, but a year ago, in the beginning of, well, basically when Biden was inaugurated, right around that time, his policies changed in a dramatic way. Cracking down on media, charging his opponents, including Poroshenko, with treason, shutting down media outlets, opposition media outlets. And so, you know, the atmosphere was getting worse and worse. And I think people started asking at that point, like, who is actually backing Zelensky, or who is telling him to go this way? Where is his power? Because when he first came in, I think everybody pretty much agreed, Ihor Kolomoisky, I mean, Zelensky got into power because of mass dissatisfaction with the outcome of the Maidan Revolution. Not that people are anti-Western, but the Maidan Revolution itself turned out to, you know, to just be an absolute betrayal to most people. The nasty nationalism, divisiveness, the corruption, everybody got poorer, like everything got worse. So they voted in a Russian-speaking Jew in a historically anti-Semitic country, overwhelmingly, like by a huger, larger margin than any president previously. It was a rejection, really, of the kind of divisive, you know, violent post Might on Politics. Over time, though, for reasons that are kind of unclear, Zelensky, well, his popularity started to go down. He wasn't able to really do a deal. He wasn't able to kind of get a Minsk II sort of final deal with the Russians to get peace that he had been voted into office to finally get peace in the Donbass. It wasn't working out. Part of that may have been the Russians. Part of it definitely was the fact that the nationalists in Ukraine, even if they're not a majority, are extremely powerful. And, you know, they threatened from the day he won office. They and the Western-backed NGO community threatened him with another Maidan if he went too far with peace with Russia, that it would be seen as a betrayal. And so the question is, yeah, who's he relying on now? I mean, I my guess is a faction of Ukraine's Siloviki, the security structures. I don't know about oligarch-wise. I mean, he seems to be closer to basically his own Siloviki and, you know, Washington. That's my best guess. But then beyond that, you know, Ukraine is in some ways, it's more like Russia in the 90s. It's never been like now, thanks to Putin's insane invasion, stupid invasion, Ukraine, I think finally might get, is finally sort of unified in a sense, in a way that it really hasn't been, as we've seen with every election. But so even if, you know, Zelensky, let's say before the war, just before the war, Zelensky was backed by his Siloviki, Washington, and maybe a one or two very pro-Western or Western-friendly oligarchs. You know, now, I mean, now they're definitely united there, and now the media, I guess people, no one's going to really talk about it now, basically. All the divisions that are normally there and have always been there for the last 31 years, this country is very hard to sort of centralize. I think now it is finally kind of unified and centralized. So when you say that people aren't really talking about power, I don't know if in part, I'm sure that's because you're a Western journalist and they're all very conscious of how important Ukraine's image is for this war. And Ukrainians are very patriotic. But part of it is, yeah, I think they've finally been unified of purpose, and they really weren't before. This is interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. And lest I sound too sort of skeptical towards Ukraine or too jaundiced towards Ukraine, I think a lot of that solidarity and coming together is real.
Yes, totally.
And I think a lot of divisions have really been put aside because of the exigencies of responding to the invasion. But nevertheless, you have to assume that those divisions still exist just under the surface. And speaking of, you know, Zelensky's team, there was that one guy that was part of like their negotiating team.
Yes.
When they went to Minsk, if I'm not mistaken, to negotiate with the Russians. And when they came back, they just shot and killed him.
Yes.
And they were like, oh, he was a Russian spy. And then everyone just sort of moved on from that. And I was thinking like, wait, what now? What was he doing exactly? Who was this guy?
Yeah, that was Denis Kiryev. Nobody really has made sense of that killing. I think we've talked about it a little bit on the show, but after they came back from one of their negotiations, the SBU bragged, the SBU, which is the spy agency, bragged about killing him, that they had information that he was working with the Russians, that he was basically a double agent. Maybe he was in touch with them. And then shortly after that, the GUR, the Ukraine's military intelligence, said he's a hero and he was killed in the line of duty. So this is like maybe some cross rival, you know, cross agency rivalry, or one agency wasn't telling the other agency what the operation was, or, you know, who knows what. I mean, one thing about the shaping of our perception of Ukraine, I mean, I'm just thinking about this now. It's funny. I mean, before the war, anybody who was in any way half honest and about Ukraine would say it's a deeply messed up country and you root for it. But it's very messed up, very divided, very poor. Millions of migrant workers, at least used to be in Russia. I don't know how, at least there have to be at least 1 million, maybe 2 million in Russia. And there always had been, because Ukraine is a lot poorer than Russia.
I think another thing that's given short shrift in Western media coverage of Ukraine is the influence that that institution has over everything.
Yes.
They really have a sort of superior position towards the military with respect to seniority. I was unable to interview very many Ukrainian military officials because of difficulties with access. But the one time I did interview Admiral Igor Voronchenko, who's the Inspector General of the Ukrainian Armed Forces, there was a guy from the SBU who was there standing literally behind his shoulder.
Jeez.
You know, who was telling him what he could and could not answer. I remember because one thing I had heard from a number of people was that although the International Legion, the much ballyhooed International Legion, turned out to be mostly a myth or mostly a propaganda stunt, as far as I could tell, everyone did agree that there was a small number of like ex-special operators from the US, Britain, and France that were on the front lines. And so I was constantly trying to figure out who exactly these guys were. And I asked Voronchenko about that. And I said, you know, are all these guys ex-operators? And he was about to answer. And then the SBU guy like nixed it and was like, no, man.
Wow.
And then so the admiral sort of smiled and was like, I can't say, but, you know, they have, they're very highly skilled. They're very well qualified or something to that effect.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you more about that. The brief thing I was trying to get back to was just that this new image of Ukraine is like basically very basically wealthy Western European, efficient, everything kind of is happy, you know, smooth, perfect, patriotic. It's very new and it's only a wartime thing, but that was the point I was gonna make, but whatever. I'm actually more interested in what you were just saying. So you're reporting there on the war and specifically on the International Legion that got a lot of press early on about thousands or tens of thousands of Westerners mostly going to fight there for Ukraine to fight this righteous war against the Russian invaders. And then we started getting a few stories coming back. There was that well-known sort of bombing of a barracks, I think, near Lviv, that killed, again, everything shrouded in mystery always. But then you started getting these reports from some of these veterans leaving saying, man, that sucked. You know, this was no war getting out of there. So tell us what your angle is on this and what you were able to find.
I'm so glad you mentioned that. So the story that I had assigned was to report on the International Legion. And I had, you know, I'd previously written about foreign fighters in Syria. So it was a subject that I had some experience with, especially because a lot of the people who fought with the YPG in Syria against ISIS also have tried to join with the Ukrainians. Mm. So I went over there expecting to find more or less the same sort of situation, although it seemed like a lot more volunteers were going to Ukraine, and ultimately found a ton of you know, would-be volunteers who were very deluded and confused, who knew less about the situation than I did, and who were all sort of pursuing their separate schemes to finagle their way into the Ukrainian army. There was no real coordinated effort to group them together, to train them, to deploy them. And the misinformation among these guys was completely rife. They were all under the impression that Westerners were getting slaughtered on the front lines, that were getting sent, you know, like as a meat shield in front of the Ukrainian army, and that the Ukrainians weren't even fighting. You know, it's just all foreigners who are dying. That's the kind of misinformation that I was hearing among, you know, the Westerners knocking around Warsaw and the border and in Lviv.
Where would they get their misinformation from, though? That's weird, because that's not
just pure rumors. And it's a function of the lack of any real unit that could be described as an international legion. Like the Ukrainians did it 2 days after the invasion. They announced this big thing. They told everyone to apply through the embassies. And I actually sent in, because I'm a veteran of the Iraq War, so just to learn more information, I sent an email. I followed the instructions that they put out on their website to join. And I emailed the nearest Ukrainian consulate in Houston and attached all my paperwork, and they just didn't respond. And you know, you're looking on Reddit, where there was like a community for people who are trying to volunteer, they all have the same experience. So the Ukrainians weren't responding to any of these applications, and so a bunch of people just went on their own, thinking that the embassies were overwhelmed with emails and they should just go directly to the border and try to sign up there. So that's what led to all of these guys just sort of wandering aimlessly around Ukraine and having all of their stories. They're wildly inaccurate and diluted stories, including many sort of, I think, tall tales of experiencing brushes with Russian forces in combat. All this being reported in just dozens and dozens of articles, you know, including New York Times, the Washington Post. I've looked at some of those articles, highly credulous. The people that they quote, it just seemed like pure confusion, and underneath it, it was mostly illusory.
This is amazing. So yeah. You're saying you saw these guys, a lot of them sound like fantasists, and that's an element of volunteering in a lot of wars. You get these fantasists. Mm-hmm. And they were being quoted as if they were a reliable source?
Oh, totally. Yeah, look at the Washington Post reporting on the Foreign Legion. I mean, they repeatedly quote this guy named Damien McGrew, who's like a Norwegian lawyer who claims to be the spokesman for the International Legion. As far as I can tell, he has no connection at all to the Ukrainian military. They said that this woman named Sandra Anderson Ira, who's a sort of social media Instagram influencer, ardent fundraiser. They said that she had been on the front lines for the majority of the conflict. It's totally preposterous.
Oh my God.
There's no way that this woman is actually fighting. There was quite a bit of that. The New York Times, to its credit, although it published like these really glowing profiles of the Americans, veterans who are like taking the fight to Russian forces, they dropped in like a little note in their big article on this that was like the FYI, the New York Times is unable to identify any veterans actively fighting in Ukraine, which was a real tell. I guess one of their fact checkers realized that this stuff could be verified.
Right.
But to bring it all back to the point that Mark was making about the strike on the Yevorov base, I mean, that was a big deal when that happened, because it was right after the International Legion was created. You had all of these Westerners coming over to Ukraine. They were all concentrated on this base, which is about 10 miles from the Polish border. And for Russia to just dump like 30 cruise missiles on top of that was like a shockingly aggressive response to this International Legion business, because it was so far from the fighting. You know, the Ukrainians may have never had any intention of actually bringing those guys to the fight.
But
you know, there's one video of the aftermath, just one, that shows like buildings burning around like this 40-foot deep crater, a crater so deep that you can see like the water table has been penetrated at the bottom of it.
Jesus.
And that was just one of about 30 missiles that
I didn't realize there were 30. That's insane.
And it seems certain that like dozens of foreigners have been killed in this attack. Russia claimed to have killed 180 foreigners in that attack.
Right.
The Ukrainians said that no foreigners died at all. It was just 35 Ukrainians. Neither of those really makes a lot of sense. It seems certain that a bunch of foreigners had died. Everyone that I spoke to who had been at the Yevorov base said that they had seen with their own eyes, like Westerners who had been killed and who were like lying in the rubble. So I couldn't make any sense of it. It didn't seem possible that the Ukrainians could be concealing so many deaths, but it also didn't seem possible that all foreigners could have escaped getting killed in such an onslaught of cruise missiles. That's one of the strangest and most unexplained events, I think, of the entire war.
You mentioned that the base was on the Polish border. So would that imply they were warehousing these people as propaganda assets rather than planning to use them in combat?
That's absolutely, you know, my sense of it.
From talking to people, though, is your sense that definitely some Westerners, if not many Westerners, were killed in it?
Yes. Yeah. However, at the same time, it doesn't seem possible that the Ukrainians could conceal so many deaths. There was one unconfirmed report in the Daily Mirror that three former British special operators died at Yevorov, but that's uncorroborated. I really don't get it. I mean, it's more than just ordinary fog of war around that particular incident.
How much of it do you think, like, what's your sense of Western reporters there? Because honestly, when you said that, when you raised even very fair and reasonable, not at all kind of hostile, you know, skeptical questions about Zelensky and his regime, I have not heard any journalists go near such an insinuation, which is not a good thing. I mean, a journalist should always, I mean, you're taught that, you know, you went to journalism school, and I mean, I'm doing this job, like, you should always ask where's the power here, and where's the power behind the throne, sort of thing. But was it your sense when you were out there that journalists are very kind of, I don't know, reluctant to ask questions that would make you basically uncomfortable questions about the Ukraine side of the story, or no?
You know, it's a mixed bag. I can't speak about, you know, all Western journalists as a group. I know there's lots of people who are honest and hardworking, who are trying to do the best, and who are bringing that skepticism to bear. I will say, though, that the one press conference I went to with Zelensky, I was just, oh man, I was just shaking my head at the questions that the American and British reporters asked, because one after another, they all asked exactly the same thing, which was, are you getting all the weapons that you need? Are you happy with the equipment that you're getting from the United States? Could you tell people what the dire consequences would be if the U.S. and the United Kingdom stopped for 1 second sending heavy weapons to Ukraine?
Wow.
And it was like they were, you know, lobbyists for Raytheon or something. And it was funny because there was also a Chinese reporter there. Not sure what outlet he was for. But he was, you know, the representative from Chinese state media, and he was sort of asking the opposite question. He was like trying to get Zelensky to admit, you know, that his constant appeals for weapons from Western countries was not helpful to the situation. So I saw very little difference between sort of Chinese state media and U.S. corporate media on opposite sides of this question. Right. It wasn't interesting at all. The only interesting or perceptive questions at that press conference were asked by Ukrainian journalists. Yes. And the significance of them was really lost on me, because I'm not a specialist at all of Eastern Europe, or not a Russian speaker or Ukrainian speaker. But I did notice that one Ukrainian reporter asked Zelensky a question about a certain oligarch. He said, and I didn't catch the name, but she said, you know, this oligarch has been seen recently in Kyiv. Can you tell us about, like, his role in the negotiations with Russia? And I remember Zelensky said, I'm not ready to talk about that right now. And it made an impression on me because it was the only question he didn't like answer, like, with gusto, you know. He clearly didn't want to talk about this person. I was just left scratching my head, like, wait, what? What's going on here?
That's interesting. Yeah, you know, again, Ukraine, even though Ukrainians might be are certainly rallying around the leader right now, but they do really have a lot of good journalists, those who haven't been driven out of the country or silenced by other means. But that's kind of amazing story too.
That press conference was held in a train station deep underneath Kyiv. And it was a surreal setting, because, you know, I went down the longest escalator I've ever been on in my life. It must have been 10 stories straight down. To this train platform that they had set up like a briefing area. And shortly after this press conference, there was a report on the Western intelligence support for Ukraine. And one of the things that I think it was in the New York Times, they said, was that the CIA was helping the government with its like personal security, like Zelensky's security and the security of his team. And during the press conference, I was just sort of sitting there waiting for Zelensky to come down. There's all these Ukrainian soldiers and like trains actually going past on the platform. And a guy came walking down the steps on the other side of the platform, just flanked by a team of like Ukrainian commandos who were in black masks. And I thought, well, that's Zelensky. See, because clearly him, he's coming closer and approaching, and he's like sort of, he's dressed like Zelensky. He looks exactly like Zelensky. Same exact hair, same beard. He's sort of shaking hands with people, making the rounds, kind of like winking at these people over there. And as all this is happening, it's slowly dawning on me that this guy he's not quite Zelensky. Like, it's not exactly him. I thought he was a little bit younger than Zelensky. And then I realized that this guy is a body double that they've sent out in front of the actual president. And it was like another 20 minutes before the real Zelensky came down. And I was just thinking, holy shit, this guy's actual job is like absorb Russian assassinations. Yeah.
One of those hard to insure professions.
yeah.
Well, it's, what was,
I wonder if the oligarch they asked about was the guy who's supposed to be Zelensky's backer,
Kolomoisky.
Kolomoisky.
Yeah. If it was Kolomoisky or Akhmetov.
You know, they said his name. I wasn't, before when we talked before this, I was telling you guys, like, you know, as a longtime listener of the show, I'm almost intimidated to come on and talk to y'all about Ukraine because I feel like you certainly know more about it than I do.
Mark does. I don't.
I got to say, like, I mean, it's, no, just to go into, look, I mean, I've followed this region now for what, you know, almost 30 years and report on over 20 years. And Ukraine is still, well, even Russia for that matter. I mean, there's, it's still giant areas of just total black box mystery for me. It's almost like sometimes the more you know, the less you know. So it's not that. What impresses me is that you can go into this situation. I mean, it's intimidating on many levels. On top of the fact that there's a war going on, you don't know if you're going to be bombed, but it's very intimidating to go into this situation as you did, not knowing Russian or Ukrainian language, right? You don't know those languages and didn't have, and you're able to still work on a story. I mean, it's, I don't know. I'm personally really impressed. You know, I mean, yeah, it takes a long time to get to know what is the difference between a Kolomoisky and an Akhmetov and a Pinchuk and, you know, and like, yeah, what do they even mean and so on. And yeah, you know, Akhmetov is the guy who owns, or owned, I guess, was it Azovstal, the giant steel plant where the Azov regiment guys are still kind of holed up, the richest oligarch. Zelensky accused him of being part of a plot with the FSB to stage a coup last November, but then that apparently went away and he's all good again. So who knows? That's interesting, though.
It's remarkable the amount of cohesion they've been able to show.
Yes.
Especially sort of outward oriented cohesion in the media, because there are really not a lot of cracks in this facade.
It tracks with something that we've been looking at in many different wars. There's a really scary trend, which is that you can control the narrative better the less access you allow journalists, the less access you allow to media. And if you have a friendly Western media, it kind of behooves you not to allow any journalists into the area, because then all you control all the stories that go out from there, and you can make them perfectly standard and everybody will get the same narrative that's tilted to your purposes. We saw this with the retaking of Aleppo. Nobody was in Aleppo, East Aleppo, that is, the jihad-controlled area, because it was too dangerous. You couldn't make a deal, because if you made a deal with one of the groups that controlled a neighborhood or two, another of the groups would kidnap you
and maybe kill you.
Sell
you to ISIS or whatever.
Kill you, sell you. And that worked out very well, because the atrocity stories that came out of Aleppo turned out to be vastly exaggerated, but they served their purpose. And once they were revealed as exaggerations, that was because the place had fallen and there was no further use for them. In Tigray, for example, another recent war, the government just immediately shut down all the Wi-Fi for the whole province, all communications for the province. And that was fairly easy to do because, frankly, the Western media didn't have much will to find out what was going on in Tigray. So they were content not so much to push a positive narrative, the Ethiopian government, as to shut down the whole thing. But there is this trend that, you know, instead of embedding media, because that can always go wrong, you just exclude them and then, I guess, send them to exactly this kind of media center that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. You know, a colleague of mine at Rolling Stone, Mac William Bishop, just published an article that I thought was really good from Ukraine. And it's the first, and as far as I can tell, only embedded report with some guys who were out in the east of the country. And I called him up yesterday and was talking to him about, you know, how did you get this access? And so he's been in the country for a while, and was on friendly terms with like some guys in the Ukrainian Marines, if I'm not mistaken. And also knowing Max, you know, some bottles of whiskey may have traded hands, but you know, he told me that his strategy was basically to not ask permission. Like he didn't ask permission from the military authorities. He just went out to where he knew these guys were, and they sort of tolerated him sort of spending the night at their base with him. And it looks like they required him to keep casualty stats off the record, but throughout the piece that, that he published in the last issue of Rolling Stone, you know, he constantly hints at really steep casualties among the Ukrainians. And he also included this one really chilling scene where he was driving past or they had stopped at some morgue and the door was open and he just saw just bodies upon bodies just like stacked up to the door of this morgue. So I think that, you know, one of the main things that the Ukrainians are concealing, for lack of a better word, is really heavy casualties, you know, in the Ukrainian army. And it's pretty clear why they would want to keep that a secret, but it also, it's pretty dark to think about, especially when you see like the sort of ecstatic cheerleading for this war and the sort of complete lack of interest in.
There is a cynical meme which has some truth to it that the United States is willing to fight Russia to the last Ukrainian. There's something to that. Not that the Ukrainians don't have their own perfectly good reasons for fighting, but they are serving an imperial purpose at the same time, which is pretty god-awful.
Even the New Yorker just came out and described it as a proxy war. Like it's become almost a, for a while you weren't supposed to say it because that meant you were a Putinist. I mean, obviously for Ukrainians, it's not a, it's a war for, you know, for liberation, fighting off an invader, but it's not the same for everybody. And for the US now with the $33 billion package, I mean, it's now mainstream okay to almost boast. They're boasting almost that it's a proxy war, almost to get people more sort of united behind it. It's a really strange, weird thing, and seems to me pretty damn dangerous, especially when we have so little information about what's going on the front. But anyway, John, you, I cut you off.
Yeah, I was going to ask if any other journalists, well, let's say Anglo journalists, English speaking journalists, showed any interest in tracking down Ukrainian casualties.
I don't know. I was pretty much on my own most of the time. I'm afraid I can't answer that.
Yeah.
I know that the only
I probably have this old movie idea of journalists as guys who wear fedoras and are always like, "Hey, you hear anything?
What's the rumpus?"
Most wars I reported on have been like completely by myself. This time, actually, there was a sort of stereotypical like journalist hangout. There's a place in Kyiv called the Buena Vista where all the journalists go to get drunk. But there's not a whole lot of shop talk. There's like, they're like kind of keeping their, no one's really comparing notes.
Yeah.
You know, speaking of all this stuff before we get, this isn't directly related, but speaking of all this stuff, the information control, Western news media reports, what exactly is being concealed, et cetera. Maybe I can touch on probably what's the most controversial of all of these things.
Yes.
Which is Bucha.
Yes.
And
you were there when it was first revealed, at least. So
I was very close by. I was actually in Zabuchichia, which is a few miles away. But here's what I'll say about Bucha. It's not to deny that Russia committed atrocities there. I have no doubt that they absolutely did. That's what invading armies do. That's why invasions like this are completely illegal and are total war crime and should be condemned in the strongest terms, is because you can't control your troops from doing things like that. That said, that site was completely controlled by the Ukrainian military for at least a day, I think maybe 48 hours before any journalists were allowed there. And then when they were allowed there, it was on it was on police transport vans that they were taken as a group. Like you had to sign up. I was on this mailing list for everyone who's written about Buka. I was on the same mailing list getting the same information as them. And you had to go at a certain time to the media center in Kyiv, show your documents, get on a van with, it's a police van accompanied by Ukrainian police. And they basically took people on guided tours of Buka to look at the dead bodies that were still laying in the street and to interview, you know, Ukrainians. So it's just to say, it's just to point out that those reports are not based on like independent gumshoe sleuthing.
Right.
There were not, it wasn't the, you had New York Times reporters who were just with the troops who found this. Like the scene was highly, highly controlled. I'm not implying anything about that. I'm not implying any sort of dark conspiracy behind that. I think it's just something that people should be, you know, aware of.
I think that makes a lot of sense because there are questions. I mean, it's probably not as simple. It's not like a My Lai massacre necessarily, but there were definitely, this is our sense that we've said, in fact, some of our subscribers, a few of them anyway, seem to not like hearing it, but that it makes a lot of sense given it's an invasion and a war and you're an occupying force in hostile territory and then you're having to withdraw bitterly, and that happens. You do see militaries killing people like that. It does happen a lot. But yeah, I remember even the first New York Times reports, they were walking around with Azov regiment guy. Azov seems to be in a lot more places than I would have expected. And they even put that in their report. And that's never a good sign, you know, if the Azov battalion is on a potential war crime scene before you, the journalist, are. I'm glad you brought that up though, because I was going to ask you about that. And it is frustrating that there's just, look, there's, journalism has a lot of social pressures, as you know, career pressures and social pressures. And journalists who kind of hide that the most, put it this way, journalists who was going to talk about that aspect of the story is going to have a harder time than journalists who don't.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was in these other towns nearby, near Buka, and I have absolutely no love for the Russians. There's nothing I would have liked more than to uncover evidence of Russian war crimes. But talking to people in these liberated areas, I was also in Boyarka, and I'd ask people, like, did the Russians commit abuses? Did they kill people? Did they rape women? That kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I was told in both of these places, no, they camped out in the forest. They sometimes came into town and they mostly just left people alone. And you can't really write that though. You can't, no one's going to want to hear that to say that, like, well, yes, something happened in Buka. I don't know exactly what, something very bad happened there. But in other places, it looks like the Russians were under orders to leave the people alone, which is generally what commanders will tell their troops. Like, don't fucking rape people. Don't steal stuff. That kind of thing. So I don't think there's anything different about the Russians in this context, but you can't add that perspective. You can't add that context. It's just this maximalist narrative of, like, they're doing a genocide and trying to, like, eliminate Ukrainians from the face of the earth. Which I don't think is exactly the case, but, you know, speaking of Azov, I interviewed Andrew Beletsky, Azov. Yeah, at the Azov base in Kyiv. And
this is the co-founder or founder of the Azov battalion. He's Russian. He's either Belarusian born or Russian. He's Belarusian, and then was a Russian neo-Nazi, and then made his way to Ukraine, like a lot of Russian Nazis did.
And at the time, so he actually stepped away from his role with Azov and was like a politician at the time that the invasion started. And only rejoined in a military role as a colonel in the Territorial Defense Force after the invasion. So that's why he wasn't with the actual Azov regiment in Mariupol.
Oh, I see.
And Mariupol has been by far the most significant battle of this whole war, the siege of Mariupol. Mm-hmm. And there's a bunch of reporting around it, and it is amazing how, like, de-emphasized the fact that the main defensive force in Mariupol is the Azov Azov Battalion, and that they are one of the most sort of squared away, highly respected, best trained, best equipped components of the whole Ukrainian military. And that shows in the resistance that they put up, their refusal to surrender, their commitment to fight to the death. Beletsky told me that they were 100% committed to not surrendering and dying there at the Azovstal factory. But in all the reporting around Mariupol, like, there was almost no mention of that. And so the Azov regiment that's been the subject of so much reporting over the years because of their neo-Nazi tendencies, that regiment is in danger, remains in danger at this moment of being killed, like, to a man, and is not existing anymore. And Beletsky was in Kyiv because he was organizing new Azov units headed up by veterans of the war in the Donbass, Azov veterans of the war in the Donbass. And so those units that you mentioned that were with the New York Times and Bukha were one of these new Azov units, these second generation Azov units that Beletsky is in charge of. Creating.
Right.
And, you know, I asked him about the neo-Nazi stuff, about the pagan symbology, about white supremacy and all these things. And he didn't totally downplay it or totally deny it, but, you know, his perspective or the point that he wanted to make was like that they've never tried to invade anyone else. They've like never tried to subjugate anyone else. Like, he's basically saying, look, we're not, you know, a terrorist organization. We're just super right wing. And, you know, I think there's some truth to or some fairness to that point. But at the same time, like, Azov's ideology is a matter of public record. I mean, in the base that where I visited them, they have like their infamous flag that looks just like the SS flag.
Yeah, it's there's the like wolf black, symbol.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's like black sun clocks like on the wall that are that are really ominous looking, backlit in blue neon. And there was also spray painted on the wall in like block letters in English. It just said straight up white power outside of the base. So that's Azov. And, you know, whatever you make of them, you know, what I can tell you about them is that they're growing, like they're expanding. There's more of them than there ever has been based on the extraordinary increase in the unit's prestige in Ukraine as a result of the Battle of Mariupol. Because while Western media has been downplaying it completely, to Ukrainians, in Ukrainian eyes, like, Azov are like real heroes of this war.
You can see that on social media.
Something similar happened with Islamic State among Sunni populations in the Middle East. It was, you know, you against a backdrop of what they saw as generations of defeat and humiliation, there's this group that never compromises at all and fights to the death. And they admired that. Many joined, which is sort of horrible in the larger context, but understandable.
Yeah, I think it's pretty scary too. I mean, Azov has had a pretty big influence on sort of the global, I don't know, neo-Nazi, white supremacist kind of movement, because and it's going to get much bigger because of their success, because of their sort of mainstreaming. I mean, you see how in the New York Times they used to describe him as neo-Nazi, then and the war started and they got started getting called far right, and now they're just called a right wing unit of the military. I mean, the language keeps sort of dancing around it, or they say, you know, they've evolved. I'm not sure they've evolved. The whole point is they're willing to die because they're extremists, and that's why they're useful and good at fighting and dying, and better than most, because that's what extremism does. They're useful in war, but it is dangerous. And you also got to wonder how much support they're getting from, I mean, you just got to assume they're getting a lot of support from NATO.
They're getting support from Elon Musk. Beletsky called out Musk by name. He was like, yeah, thanks to Elon Musk, I can talk to the guys in Mariupol, because they had like a Starlink terminal there.
Wow. How surprising is that? Yeah. The South African brings them together. Okay. You've got this story coming out in the middle of June in Harper's about the International Legion, and I don't know how much you want to give away of that, but your general sense, if I understand it right, is that, as John said, I mean, this is mostly a PR exercise, but not much sort of substance to it. However, there are foreigners, Westerners, fighting in ways we don't quite yet understand at all, right? Because, I mean, we heard about this apparent private contractor from Tennessee who was just killed. We heard about a British guy who was killed. But is that generally your sense?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it was a brilliant PR move by the Ukrainians. I don't even hold it against them. It's well done. That's what countries that are at war do.
Yep.
And they knocked it out of the park. It led to literally hundreds of articles, positive press, and so forth.
Yep.
The unfortunate side effect of that was all these guys who were like Amazon, like 24-year-old Amazon drivers, who drained their life savings to go over to Ukraine. And come to find out there actually is no unit that you can actually join. And as far as those, retired operators who are apparently on the front lines, that's a real gray area and possibly cause for concern, because right up until the eve of the invasion, I mean, Ukraine was thoroughly penetrated by JSOC, and there was a bunch of Green Berets that were over there. Mm-hmm. And what exactly is the dividing line between the active duty guys and the ones who, I guess, apparently remained on their own initiative just to fight? And what happens the day?
Yeah, the idea that those who are killed retired, well, it may be handy to call them that, but that isn't really the kind of job that most people retire from. I suppose that's the origin of that paradigmatic scene in every Schwarzenegger movie where he's just trying to live a private life, and then the helicopter comes back down to put him back into it. In reality, I suspect if you're the kind of guy who was in one of those groups in the first place, you're just kind of counting the days till the helicopter comes to take you back there. The funny thing is, the foreign fighters that we see about, I mean, I remember there was one case of a British guy who got himself captured.
Oh, yeah.
And he didn't look like a top-of-the-line volunteer. You know, he was one of these meaty guys with giant tattoos with various jingoistic stuff on his forearms. And he's going to get a lot of publicity. And the serious people, the JSOC people, who I would guess are not being used as ordinary infantry, but as, you know, target designators or liaisons with satellites and drones.
Exactly.
They're not going to get a lot of publicity. And if they get killed, that's regrettable, but they had already retired and, you know, nothing to do with us.
Yeah, that's the case. Beletsky, Admiral Voronchenko, and the SBU official that I interviewed were all very clear that these guys were former special operators, and that they had extraordinary skills, and that they were very useful, and that they were actively fighting on the front lines. So, you know, take that for what it's worth.
Has anybody reported that? Because I've only keep seeing that on the Russian side, and it's dismissed as conspiracy theory, but it's true. But has there been any, I haven't seen anyway, any English language reporting on that. Have you?
Not that I have seen, no. John, you mentioned the English guy. I think his name is Aislinn?
Cossack Gundy.
Yeah, Cossack Gundy, of course. Yeah. So he belongs to the first generation, the guys who were in the Donbass since 2014. And those guys widely reported to include a lot of skinhead neo-Nazi types. I've heard that firsthand from former YPG volunteers who went over to the Donbass. I think it's important to draw a distinction between the next generation or the current generation of volunteers who, as far as I could tell, were not right-wingers at all. And on the contrary, most of the ones I talked to had either totally generic political beliefs or were like centrist liberal types. And notably skewed rather older than I would have expected. A lot of them were middle-aged guys. Not in their 20s or 30s, but, you know, they were in their 40s or 50s. And there's even the most famous legionnaire of all now, Malcolm Nance, the MSNBC analyst.
The Russiagate guy, expert, for MSNBC, right? Yeah.
So that man is 61 years old, and also his wife recently passed away, if I'm not mistaken. Oh. And when I see him like busting out like on MSNBC in his full like battle gear, and just talking about I'm done talking. That's like I'm thinking, man, is anyone like watching out for this guy's mental health? Like this is not. Someone needs to take care of this
person. I saw on one report that a Ukrainian medic said that one of the big problems was not, as you would expect, combat wounds or something, but hypertension. Like, you know, we're getting a lot of middle-aged guys with high blood pressure, and for some reason, being under Grad bombardment tends to raise the blood pressure a little bit. And he was constantly handing out, I don't know, Atenolol or some blood pressure pill for them.
This thing's like a jihad for, you know, like middle-aged liberal Democrats. Something we've not seen before.
I think those people had no idea that there really is this far-right, neo-fascist, neo-Nazi adjacent element in the Ukrainian army, and just thought it was Russian propaganda and Russian disinformation, and it couldn't be true. And I guess that's why, you know, the reporting gets so pretzel twisted, because it's like you have to do your job honestly as a journalist and say, well, the Azov Battalion, they use the wolf's angle and they're white supremacists, white nationalists, and so on and so forth. But then if you do that, you're going to be almost de facto, you're going to be admitting that some Russian disinformation is actually true. And then you have to explain, well, but it's not all true. Obviously all Ukrainians aren't like that. And then I think they've just sort of decided to pretend like the problem doesn't exist at all, except in the Kremlin's mind.
Yeah. It's no time for nuance when you're talking about the media situation at the moment. And then, you know, in my role as voice of the somewhat unbalanced on the show, I have to say, I mean, you mentioned, you know, a lot of these guys are Amazon drivers. Well, what would you rather do? Be an Amazon driver or, you know, fight in a righteous war?
Save the West from Russia. I mean, it makes sense. Yeah.
It's something to do. It's something that gives like meaning and purpose to their lives. Like you can totally see how they come to that decision. There's not, for people that don't have college educations and who don't have professional jobs, there's not a lot of outlets to sort of feel like you're at the center of world events and, you know, saving the world, like someone who has a graduate degree and works for an NGO gets to feel.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I was highly sympathetic to them, even though I ultimately concluded like these guys are just completely deluded and lost and wasted their time in coming here.
Right. But it's kind of, they also kind of provide cover in a way for the real special forces, Westerns who come in a weird way. It's almost, you know, because, you can just, like the volunteers, this whole movement of volunteers can give a sense, oh, there are all these volunteers around. And the real guys get kind of inserted, you know, under cover of being a volunteer, basically. So it's also provides a good cover story. It's useful in a lot of ways, primarily as PR, though. But I want to ask you, you are a veteran, as you said. When did you serve and where did you serve?
I served in, as I was telling you in the phone call before the show, I served in literally the shittiest unit in the entire United States Army. 277th Engineer Company, shout out to the Army Reserve Unit in San Antonio, Texas.
Would they all agree?
I think a lot of them would agree.
A point of pride.
we were deployed to Iraq from 2003 to 2005. And we were completely unprepared for combat, never intended for that kind of thing. Our unit's job was to like patch potholes. Like we had an asphalt plant and a bunch of dump trucks. And we did like construction work and road work. And so we were like more like a road crew, but we were all over Iraq. Mm. And that was the problem because of the extraordinary mismanagement of the war and the overuse of reservists and National Guardsmen. So we were often in places where there was like heavy fighting taking place. We were attacked repeatedly.
Well, yeah, some sudden potholes might appear in those places.
I know.
Yeah.
My God. Yeah. What are these wires coming out of this pothole? Yeah.
No, it was, and mostly it was the driving, the transports, the convoys. Sadly, a number of guys in my unit did get killed. A much larger number got wounded. We were in quite a few firefights that were just a complete clusterfuck, just total disasters. And that whole experience left me with kind of an abiding sort of lifelong a contempt for the U.S. military command and what fools and liars they all are. Even though I, you know, retained a lot of affection for the guys that I actually served with, you know, the enlisted guys.
Well, in a way, your unit, I would guess, was composed of people who hadn't signed up for that at all, and in a way, I can see where some of your empathy for these misguided volunteers comes from.
Yeah, because it was a reserve unit in San Antonio. I don't know if it was a third or half of the guys. A lot of them were actual Mexican nationals, like born in Mexico, and had signed up to get citizenship in the United States. So, yeah, no one was prepared for the deployment that we had, which lasted like 15 months also. So it was very long too. And that was
typical. Yeah, a reserve unit that's devoted to road repair. That doesn't sound like you're going to be in a firefight. But
yeah, you can just imagine the recruiting on that. Come on, man. It's just, you're going to get citizenship and you're going to fix a few potholes outside of San Antonio. What's the big deal? Yeah.
And when people did get killed and when there were firefights, it was just breathtaking how instantly the stuff was just like covered up and buried. And officers who had made disastrous decisions got rewarded. I saw the way that they all just passed out medals to themselves. And the people who had really shown valor under extreme circumstances were completely crushed under the machinery of the military, completely denied any kind of recognition, because recognizing their sacrifices would have entailed, you know, admitting that that things had gone wrong.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. Like, heroism comes out when everything's messed up.
Yeah.
That's a great point. I hadn't fully realized that, but it makes absolute sense.
And I can see where your skepticism towards, you know, what power's telling you chops kind of came out of that experience, I imagine, when going into the Ukraine war and seeing it as a veteran and somebody who, because, you know, we talked about this, I think, with your Harper's colleague, Andrew Coburn. I mean, one of the big kind of cultural differences, shifts that happen from sort of the post-war period versus like the post-Reagan period is, I don't know, it's from, you know, Catch-22 through Stripes, the Army was seen as comical. And it wasn't seen as this, I wouldn't say always comical, but it had that element of bureaucratic absurdity, inanity, vanity, you know, and it was this... people poked fun at it all the time. And then also, of course, people were very patriotic and loved it, but there was kind of the two-sided thing. And then in the Reagan years with Hollywood and Reagan, and ever since, it suddenly the military is seen as this perfect, highly efficient, nobody wastes 1 second machine, and every, you know, the most efficient, reliable, machine-like part of the United States, and like they should be in charge of the government too. They're so darn efficient and effective. It's very weird. It's a big cultural shift. Unfortunately, I'm old enough to have seen that shift happen, and it's
I know exactly what you mean. And now, of course, it's the cult of special forces.
Yes.
And the aggrandizement of anything to do with special operations, and the creation of like a two-tier military.
Yes.
Where the much larger conventional military is relegated to a support role. And then you just have these guys who are like rock stars, totally lionized in all sorts of movies and books, et cetera.
Yep.
Well, like rock stars in their drug use habits as well, as you wrote at length in your excellent article about the Fort Bragg deaths.
Yes, and I'd be happy to talk about that if you guys think we have enough time.
Yeah. We wanted to get to that and see how professionally we segued to Fort Ragnar to start.
Oh, that was good.
That's where they pay us the big bucks.
Those Patreon bucks.
What we were going to talk about is your excellent article, The Fort Bragg Murders, for Rolling Stone, a long piece, but it's just pretty jaw-dropping, amazing. And in fact, I think you talked with the TruAnon guys about this. That's where I first heard of you, was when you talked to them about it. I don't think people know about this, and yet it seems kind of weirdly not totally surprising how sort of rock and roll in a 70s way these guys' lifestyles. I don't know if the sex part of it is there much, but definitely
unfortunately,
the drugs.
In a dark way, there's a lot of sexual assault associated with all of this stuff as well.
Right.
It's funny that I talked to a Delta Force Lieutenant Colonel named Jim Reese not too long ago, because I have a follow-up to the Fort Bragg murders coming out in Rolling Stone pretty soon.
Okay.
He was telling me about the rock star lifestyle of people that are in JSOC, special mission units.
Mm-hmm.
And he was saying, like, you know, first of all, they get paid a lot more. It's not like Wall Street money, but you're talking about $80,000, $90,000 salaries. And that there's a lot of combat pay. There's a lot of like hazardous duty pay. They're treated like gods within the military. Like they do whatever they want. They wear whatever uniforms. Everything that they do is classified. They have their own facilities that nobody else can go to. That no one, like, they're basically outside the chain of command entirely. JSOC is a vertically integrated chain of command that goes straight up to the president and cuts out everybody else, including the Secretary of Defense and Congress.
Mm.
And the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So within that environment, there's, they have so much autonomy, and that type of power ends up corrupting, especially after, 20 years of war. And, a big aspect of it is drug use, especially
cocaine. Yeah, it sounded like a steady diet of steroids, cocaine, ecstasy,
speed,
tramadol,
and prescription
tramadol. Yeah, you got to have the down in there too. You got to sleep sometimes.
Yeah. To say nothing, of course, of like copious amounts of alcohol, which of course soldiers have consumed.
That's true. Yeah, they always leave out the alcohol, even though in your story, one of the survivors mentioned, "No, he was fine on coke, but when he got drunk, oh, that was bad."
Yeah. Which is that makes sense.
Yeah. But it more generally around Fort Bragg, so there was those crazy murders that people that I hope people will read about. More generally, the main story I've been tracking there is just an extraordinary number of deaths that have taken place at Fort Bragg since the start of 2020, and almost complete lack of reporting about it. And I was coming to it after the Fort Hood stuff, where like 28 soldiers had died in one year, and that had led to the entire chain of command getting relieved. A congressional investigation, all this stuff. And, not even 2 months later, I was looking at Fort Bragg and I was like, wait a minute, he's got twice as many deaths here. There would have been like 45 in 2020. And the difference between those two places is that Fort Hood is just a logistics base full of a bunch of, regular privates and specialists, where Fort Bragg is the premier army installation. It's the home of JSOC, home of Special Forces, the Green Berets, all of that. And the public, the press officers, the PAOs, the public affairs officers, are just straight up lying about the number of soldiers that have died there. I mean, they're not like, fudging the numbers either. I mean, they have totally lied to me on the record and to other reporters I know about the number of active duty soldiers in uniform who have died on Fort Bragg in the last 2 years. And I know the real numbers because I did some FOIA requests for the Army Human Resources Command, because it's actually pretty easy to get casualty reports. It's one of the one things that they can't hide under the exceptions to FOIA for national security. And it is staggering how many of these deaths, these military death certificates, say that it's the person died from an undetermined cause. I'm talking about literally dozens of soldiers who you don't even know, like, how they died. Was it a gunshot wound? Was it, an overdose? Was it something else? Like, it doesn't say how they died. It doesn't say anything about it. And there's also have been, additional unsolved murders. There's a lot of, like, soldier-owned soldier violence going on. There's a lot of drug trafficking cases. that are currently docketed at Fort Bragg. There's been a number of incidents of Green Berets who have been smuggling, large quantities of narcotics into the United States, sometimes using military aircraft. And among, special operations soldiers, there is pervasive use of cocaine, and the supply of cocaine is highly contaminated with fentanyl. And so my working assumption, a working hypothesis around all of these deaths, because at this point, the body count that I'm tracking is up to January of this year, is 101 soldiers that have died. And these are, these are guys in their 20s and 30s who are presumably in pretty good health, good enough health to pass like an Army physical fitness test at least, who are screened before they can join for, sort of the medical conditions that can cause you to just drop dead. So each one of these deaths ought to require an explanation. And although suicide is a huge part of it, the deaths from suicide that says self-inflicted on the death certificate, and looking at all these other cases where there's no explanation, my working hypothesis is that they're fentanyl overdoses, because that is now the leading cause of death among people under the age of 45 in the United States.
Wow.
And as you reported, JSOC refuses even to say whether these guys are tested at all, which presumably means they're not, because they're elite and the elite can do what they want. It's an odd microcosm of the larger culture. I mean, you don't hear a lot of Wall Street guys getting arrested for drug use, and you don't hear about these guys getting arrested for it either.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah, the Army has a huge drug problem, and there is no reporting on it. You might think the assumption would be, well, someone at some point has written about drug use in the Army, but try Googling it. You will find nothing.
That's
try
wild.
Finding online, how many overdose deaths take place in the armed forces. Nothing. There's nothing.
So that was such a big story when I was younger, was drug use in the military and, and all the controversies and conspiracies that went on with it, the trafficking.
Yeah, but that was Vietnam. That was before the thank you for your service era. That was a very different tone.
Yeah, that was in the glasnost era of America, I guess. I just have a quick question, or two quick questions about it. One is, all that drug running, well, it sounds like there's a large market of service people who use drugs, so that might explain it on its own. But normally you'd think, well, if Green Berets and JSOC got, SEALs and whoever else are using their, basically their legal immunity to traffic drugs, they're building up black ops war chest for whatever the hell. Maybe they don't even need that anymore. Maybe nobody even cares and they can do, is it just drug running and that's it? Or is there some other purpose for it, do you think?
Yeah, definitely tracking those kind of conspiracy theories from back in the day are not conspiracy theories. It's real. The Dark Alliance stuff.
Yeah.
Personally, I really doubt that, JSOC itself, why would they need to run drugs?
Exactly.
They get all the money that
they
want.
They have an open budget. They can get what they
want.
And
no one's prying in or, trying too hard anyway. And so, they're protected.
But what is interesting is when you describe that totally vertical structure parallel to and distinct from the main armed forces. I mean, once we try to think of America as if it were another country, and because we're not great believers in exceptionalism, and when you do that, you think, oh, why would you organize a completely distinct military hierarchy? And that's either to prevent coups or to do coups. And whether, maybe that wasn't the original purpose with JSOC, who knows, but it could come in very handy for that.
JSOC is a covert military within the military that I think we know little to nothing about. And it's crazy how invisible they have stayed, even though their power has eclipsed practically every other institution in the United States government, including the CIA and the State Department. I mean, JSOC is, I think, the most prestigious, influential agency that's in Washington. And the commander of JSOC is always a very important person who is the president, who is in the same room as the president. And what exactly...
Very Praetorian Guard.
Yes.
But their basic purpose... Yeah, exactly. But their basic purpose is just to kill anyone in the world at any time that the president wants dead.
Yeah. It's as if the people who have the power, the Dick Cheney times 10,000, decided, well, all the stuff we want to do isn't actually legal.
Yep.
So we need a new whole armed force that can do all that stuff that we really want to do.
Without congressional oversight, because, you know, Congress got nominal oversight over CIA, kind of, you know, the judges over NSA. I mean, they don't do anything, but I think there are all these people who are sort of, all these right-wing militarists who were scarred by the 70s, thought, I'm pretty sure JSOC kind of traces its roots back to the Reagan era, Reagan-Bush. They wanted a kill force that wouldn't be subjected to any congressional or media or any kind of oversight. And they got it.
And of course, you know, Donald Rumsfeld, I think, is probably the most important person in the story and the transformations that took place after 2001. But I think it's better to think of JSOC as an agency rather than, you know, a military division. And even just like regular enlisted operators, like a guy who's an E7, who's in Delta Force or who's on SEAL Team 6 or another special mission unit. I mean, these guys get company cars, special phones, special budgets, like apartments. People come to do their paperwork for them. They have doctors that wait on them hand and foot, that if they need prescriptions of any kind, they can get that. Their wives
this
can get
kind of like
prescriptions
the
they want.
A little bit, you know, I mean,
they don't have to wear uniforms. They don't wear uniforms. They have whatever kind of hair, facial hair that they that they would like to rock. And they live like, you know, their lifestyles reflect that sense of extreme entitlement. They can do drugs. They can drink in theater. The SEALs don't have to get, you know, COVID vaccines if they don't want to. To bring it all back to Ukraine, speaking of JSOC, when I was about to cross over the border, I called a contact of mine who's a former JSOC officer, because I knew he'd spent a lot of time in Ukraine. It was more kind of just trying to get like a safety brief from him more than anything else. And he told me, I don't know why he told me this, and I actually tweeted about this and had to delete it because I got so much criticism for repeating this. But this is a guy who's now retired, but who was instrumental in creating a certain, because within JSOC, there's also special, you know, these things just like multiply fractally, like these classified covert units. Covert units
like
within
JSOC
covert
within
units.
JSOC kind of.
That's right. And that's called the Advanced Force Operations, which is a totally denied covert operations that are done under Title 50 or Title 10. Which means that legally the government can lie about it. Like they will stand in front of a podium and say, we do not have military forces in this country, when in fact they do. Wow. There's a legal structure in the US code that allows them to do that, provided they brief it to Congress. But there's also loopholes in that to where they don't have to brief it to Congress.
Of course.
So this officer told me for a fact that there was an AFO unit that was at that time in Ukraine, which is in March. And that they were doing what he called advanced prep of the battlefield, or operational prep of the battlefield, is what he called it. He used an acronym, OPB, he said. I had to look it up, operational prep of the battlefield, which isn't, you know, it's not that nefarious. You know, basically it's a contingency plan, because JSOC does a lot of like contingency type work. Like if the US is gonna go to a war with a country, then JSOC will penetrate that country first and will be there weeks before any actions actually take place. So they're doing things like marking airstrips, identifying certain infrastructure, et cetera. You know, like I said, it wasn't anything particularly nefarious, but he told me for a fact that there were JSOC personnel in Ukraine, despite, the, you know, President Biden's denial of that. I tweeted that. I got so much, you know, criticism, like escalating nuclear tensions and so forth.
Were they saying it wasn't true, or that it wasn't patriotic to say so?
That it was unpatriotic to disclose that this unit was there, which
journalists should not disclose, should not inform the public. And Seth, you almost set off a nuclear holocaust. I hope you feel good. Hope you feel good about yourself, mister.
I was shook. I deleted it. I'm sorry. I take it back.
I'm curious, who attacked you? Were there any blue checks who did?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Well, my sense of the demographics of support for heavier and heavier Ukraine interventionism is that it's not very popular with those of us who don't matter, but it is very, very popular with those who do matter. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those strange disjunctions between the U.S. elite and the masses, if you can call them that. They don't like each other much anymore, and they don't trust each other, and they're trying to find ways to get along without each other. And I think the elite has found the perfect intervention for that.
Oh, yeah. They love this. This is the best thing that's ever happened since the invasion of Iraq. And it's really depressing that this is going to, you know, at a time when it seemed like U.S. militarism could be on the wane, and then we might have a reinvestment of some of those resources to where it's sorely needed in this country, that now it has this second wind or this new lease on life, I should say, for the weapons industry and for military contractors. But at the same time, you know what? They would have gotten that money anyway. Like
it's true, you can't win.
That's right. I mean, they would have just. So now they have an excuse to increase budgets, but they would have done it anyway.
They would have found an excuse. Yeah, but I got to say before I forget to John's point about this elite thing. You know, I reminded again when you described that scene of Western reporters, the press conference you saw deep down, this sort of stage managed press conference with Zelensky deep down in the metro station or train station. And all the only question the Western reporters were interested in is, are you getting more weapons? Can you get more weapons? What do you need? You know, tell the world how you're suffering. Like, what can we do to basically help you get more weapons and kill and die more? It reminds me of so much of the press conferences when Biden withdrew from Afghanistan, which was whatever else about Biden, it was a great thing, you know, and he took an enormous amount of heat. Like for about a week there, speaking of the people who mattered, if they had their way, they would have overthrown him. I feel like they would have, you know, tied him to the back of an electric vehicle and dragged him through the streets. I mean, they were so, I've never seen the press corps so angry, certainly at a Democrat in my lifetime, nothing close to that. It was like, how dare you humiliate us? And they were just horrified by that. And the rest of the country was like, you know, it has not been excited about that war in at least a decade. I think they weren't excited when Obama did his surge. So there is that big giant divide, and this war means a lot. The $33 billion, I just saw one way of putting it into perspective, the $33 billion lend-lease aid package that Biden just announced for Ukraine this year is, according to the New York Times, is roughly the same amount that the U.S. spent on average annually in the Afghanistan war.
God.
So that's pretty serious. And that's why we need more reporting. I mean, I hope you stick with, more Ukraine stories. I don't think this war is ending anytime soon. And it's great that somebody like you with your chops and your experience also as a veteran, along with being a reporter, that you're reporting on this, because there really doesn't seem to be a sense nearly enough of like, wait a minute, you know, Russia's wrong and Ukraine should not be invaded, but what's actually going on there? Who's actually in power? What's the state of the Ukrainian military? What are we arming? What's happening to the army? I mean, there's so many questions, and the people who matter seem to think it's immoral to even ask those questions. It's pretty scary, I find.
Well, sadly, I think that Ukraine, I totally agree that the war's not going to end anytime soon. It's crazy how quickly Ukraine went from being, this is World War III. This is war in Europe. This is the biggest war ever of our lifetimes. in February and March. And then after the Russians withdrew from Kyiv, it very quickly reverted to basically the same stalemate that it has been since 2015 or so, with the exception, of course, of the fighting that's going on in Mariupol and Mykolaiv and those places in the south. But it pretty much reverted to the same frozen conflict that it has been for years. And it was kind of, I kind of had whiplash for like, well, what's exactly the significance, or what's next? Like, what's the next phase of this war? And I think that sadly, it'll become just like the other frozen conflicts that exist in the world. And Ukraine will just be another fractured, failed state that's crawling with special operations troops from all sorts of different countries, where you can't get any information and it's really unclear what's happening. And it just goes on like that for years at a time, just like in the sort of Anbar province of Iraq or Deir ez-Zor province of Syria, or parts of Libya, Somalia. I think that that's probably what's in the future for Ukraine, unfortunately.
That's a really interesting way of putting it. I hadn't really thought of that because
No, that's very good.
it's a really good way of putting it. Yeah, because there's sort of a argument, a stupid argument if you ask me, but did Russia make a huge giant military blunder and fail at it, or was it a clever Musketovka diversion when it invaded from the north and into Kyiv and into Chernihiv and Sumy? And I mean, it's pretty darn clear that it was a disaster, and they withdrew from it. And they had a much more successful withdrawal actually from all those theaters than the actual. That's why I see it. I don't know how you see it, but that it was not just some clever Musketovka. It was a whatever it tried to achieve, it failed. But I hadn't really thought, yeah, by repurposing the war back to the Donbas, it's sort of like it's like a much bloodier version of what's gone on there since 2014, 15. Right, at least for now, yeah.
Yeah, they absolutely
And on
shit
that
the
happy
bed.
note.
Sorry, what were you gonna say? And then we'll do our happy note.
I was gonna say they absolutely shit the bed in trying to take Kyiv, but having fallen back from that and withdrawn from that, they do have a very strong position to fall back to in the Donbass. And although the Ukrainian leadership will say we're not giving up an inch of Ukrainian territory, it seems like that cat's already out of the bag. They already lost Donetsk and Luhansk a long time ago. And are they really going to do an offensive from the West to retake those areas from Russia?
Well, yeah, that's one of the unasked questions about the Ukrainian forces.
Yes.
Do they have any counteroffensive capability? And so far, it doesn't look like that. And certainly with, unprepared or half-trained forces, you want to keep them on the defensive, and that seems to be the strategy so far.
All right, on that still wretched, not very happy note, I think we can wrap up a great conversation here with Seth, reporter Seth Harp. Check him out on, well, we'll post some links and stuff, but check him out on Twitter. Check out his articles at Rolling Stone. You got several great articles. Then the Fort Bragg murders one is it's really something for the ages, and I'm looking forward to the follow-up to it. And you've got your article on the International Legion coming out in Harper's in about a month and a half. I'm really looking forward to reading that too. So, Seth, thanks for taking the time to talk with us. Very honored
Yeah,
to have
thanks,
you
Seth.
on.
This has been an amazing interview. I appreciate it.
Thank you guys so much for having me on. Longtime listener of the show.
No
Thank you
problem.
guys so much for the service that you do, keeping us, all the war nerds like myself, informed. Thanks a lot.
Oh.
Thanks, I know.
Okay.
Appreciate it. Shucks. Thanks a lot. All
All
right.
right.
Bye, everyone.
Y'all take
Thanks.
care. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.